Fanning. Weekends on 2FM.
The theatrical thunderous singer, the larger-than-life force of nature that was Meatloaf. I want to take a look at that now because he was the master, of course, of operatic rock, and his bombastic rock opera Bat Outta Hell is one of the best-selling albums of all time. Besides Rumours by Fleetwood Mac, Bat Outta Hell has spent more time in the UK album charts than any other album, and that includes everything from Best of ABBA to Dark Side of the Moon. It sold a staggering 44 million copies, the fourth biggest-selling album of all time. And the follow-up, by the way, which took 16 years, had the imaginary title of Bat Outta Hell 2. It was his sixth album. 15 million copies, that one sold. In fact, there's a song on that, I Do Anything For Love, But I Won't Do That. And it got to number one in just about every country in the world. And it's the longest song ever to do so. In fact, it's about four times longer than the average, just under 12 minutes. And then 13 years later, that's right, another 13 years, Bat Outta Hell 3, or the full title, Bat Outta Hell 3, The Monster Is Loose. And by the way, those three albums together, 65 million sales. Pretty incredible, really. Anyway, Meatloaf died a couple of days ago, as you've obviously heard, 9 months after the death of Jim Steinman. That's the man who wrote his biggest hits, as Meatloaf said last year about Steinman. We didn't know each other, we were each other. We belonged heart and soul. And in fact, Meatloaf played Ireland an awful lot, including one of the few international artists to play in the North during the Troubles. Anyhow, a colourful man with a colourful life. So I met him a couple of times, one time a couple of years after Bat Outta Hell 2, when he released Welcome to the Neighbourhood. Meatloaf.
Well then, do you think in some ways that some people are born for stardom and you're not one of those
people? Oh, Madonna is born for stardom. Yeah. Michael Jackson's born for it. I mean, these guys are, you know, he sits around and writes these songs about leave me alone and all this stuff. Yeah. I know Michael for a long time, you know, leave me alone. And I don't think so. I mean, you know, it's like I'm convinced, I'm absolutely convinced at this point that Michael hired his own private detective to discover that he wasn't married. It's just this wild thing. I was reading this article. I'm going, he did this. He set this up. And Madonna and Michael and some people are absolutely born for it. And I think that's great. I mean, Prince. I mean, these guys are born for it because they want it. They live for that. I mean, they live to have those bodyguards. They have the, you know, you don't need a bodyguard. I got news for you. Unless you're Yasser Arafat, I guarantee you don't need a bodyguard. If Madonna doesn't need a bodyguard, nobody's going to go after Madonna. If you know, what, are they going to ask her for an autograph? Oh, hark, you know. Oh, stop now, quick, before my hand falls off. But I like Madonna. I mean, I like what she does. She is a absolute, just is there. She's a worker. She is a real worker. I mean, she works really hard, and I admire that. But you don't need bodyguards unless you're going to want it's like I can land in the airport in here and just sitting there. People walk by and say hi to me. But if I've got four guys that are going to front it and walk around and talk to each other in walkie-talkies and act like Secret Service and do the excuse me, everybody's going to go, what's going on? What's going on? And all of a sudden, you know, here comes under the disguise sunglasses and who's that? It's Madonna. All of a sudden, everybody knows Madonna's there. Where if Madonna walks in the airport, walks through the airport, nobody's going to know she's there. Yeah. But that's what it's all about. You don't need it. She could go through the airport without it. Bodyguards only cause you to have trouble. Sure. If you don't have a bodyguard, you have no trouble because they need a reason to keep their job. So anyway, that's enough of that.
Okay, but another thing then about, say, Michael Jackson, Madonna, and everybody else, like pop stars are often looked up to as being sort of role models. Whether they should be or shouldn't be is not the question. The question is this, that if people look up to you, which like loads of people must, if you've sold 45 to 50 million albums, you've certainly touched an awful lot of people. The thing is, have you turned insecurity into an art form?
Have I turned, excuse me?
Well, I mean, like, if you say you were insecure, you couldn't handle the thing, it was very difficult for 6 years, you're just a normal guy, you never wanted bodyguards, you're not born for stardom. So therefore, if you're just a normal, insecure bloke, have you turned that sort of facet of a human being into an art form for loads
maybe.
Of people to say, hey?
You know, nobody's ever asked me that question, and I've never actually thought through it.
Well, here's your chance.
Yeah, that's right. You're right. I don't think I've turned insecurity into an art form, because you have to, although, in this business, anytime you're in this business, and from your side as well, and from anybody that's in, basically, I think the entire any business, there are real insecurities in it. But in this business, more than any other, there is I think rejection more than any other, because you're no matter if you there's a saying. I don't know the exact saying now. I've lost it. But if if you don't take the chance, you'll. I've totally lost it. What is it saying?
There is a tide in the affairs of men, which when taken at the flood leads on to fortune. That's Julius Caesar Shakespeare.
Fine, good. That's a good, good
just
line.
Just thought I'd throw that in.
But if you don't take the risk, you'll never gain.
That's it.
That's
exactly,
the same,
yeah.
And so when you take the risk, anytime everybody who's in this business, on my side, takes shots. Right. I mean, we take shots. Even the Beatles have taken shots, you know. Even the darlings of the media press, people like you too, they've taken shots. You know, not as many as some people, but they've taken them. And so you're always in the situation and position of rejection.
Okay.
So insecurity is always there in this. It's all, you're talking about insecurity. I think every performer has made insecurity an art form.
Meatloaf is who we're talking to and about there. This is from the mid-90s. Let's jump back in here.
Do you feel as though you do stand out in some ways? Like you're not the coolest person in the rock press.
I know I'm not. I've always been an outcast. I've been an outcast in both sides, but that's how it was. I mean, I saw that coming in 1973 when I would do, it went like this. This is a true story. I was doing Shakespeare in the Park with Raul Julia. I was doing, I did two that summer. I did Rodrigo and Othello, and I did Amiens and As You Like It. So here I am as Amiens, wearing white tights, this white looking stupid hat with some feather in it, some big white shirt, and long hair, and all these people around me looking, I'm an outcast in the middle of this society that I'm sitting in this actor society. I'm a total outcast. They think I'm a freak. I mean, they think I'm a freak of nature in the middle of all their thing. Although they respect what I'm doing. I don't know if they did until we got reviews. After we got reviews, I think they turned their respect a little bit more. But at the same time, this show goes down at 10:30, 12:30 at night. I'm now wearing a motorcycle jacket, black shirt, sort of this one maybe, black jeans, and I'm standing on stage with the drummer from Blood, Sweat, and Tears, a guy named Billy Schwartz, named Billy Cross, who's in Denmark now, some other musicians, Steinman, and I'm down at this place where Kiss started called Max's Kansas City, singing old rock and roll stuff, plus some original stuff, and down there, I'm a total freak of nature again. They're looking at me going, you just did what? Where? I was doing Shakespeare up at the Park. Oh, man. It's too weird. You're too weird. And if you're not, and the whole thing about rock and roll, which has totally confused me, and this is a great example of it. Although I was a total outcast in theater, and I did about 24 different stage productions in New York, there was not one time in the conservative world of theater where they ever said in a review, and I had reviews by Clive Barnes and everybody several times, at least 12 or 14 times, where they ever say an actor who calls himself Meatloaf, or after I did Shakespeare in the Park and Joe Papp hooked me up for an interview with a feature article in New York Times in 1973, did the man who wrote the article ask me this question, where did you get your name Meatloaf? Not once in the conservative world of theater did any of the actors ever ask me that.
Yeah.
When I went into an audition, they would always say, Meatloaf. Okay, Meat, what have you prepared for us today? They never questioned it. It wasn't only until I got into the world of where it should be, anything goes, everything is permitted, everything is allowed of rock and roll, did it suddenly become ultra conservative, and they all want to know, well, where'd you get this name Meatloaf? What are you asking me that for? And it freaked me out so much that I started just making up stories. I changed my age. I changed my real name. I made up more stories about everything than you possibly can imagine because I couldn't believe the questions all you got to do is look at anybody's name. Let's go back to you two. Bono? The Edge? You know, come on, kids. Get with the program. It's rock and roll. And then they start off, well, I'm not sure he understands the roots of rock and roll. I understand the roots of rock and roll a lot better than the guys who are writing about it do. And you know, it's just like, It's an absurd world, this rock and roll world.
Okay, it's obvious you do understand that, because if you listen to Bat Out of Hell, you'll see anything from Bob Seger to Bruce Springsteen, the whole widescreen thing pushing right through in terms of rock and roll. There's no question about that. But would you see yourself more as an entertainer than a rock and roller?
Oh, I am definitely an entertainer, but I think that's the meaning. But what is rock and roll? What was Elvis Presley? Come on, Little Richard. Let's go back to the roots of rock and roll. Let's go look at Little Richard. You're going to tell me that wop bop a loo bop a wop bam boom. That is a serious lyric. Yeah. I mean, we're talking heavy. We're talking deep, soul-penetrating lyric. No, it is fun. That's what it is. He's an entertainer. You're going to tell me that Little Richard, who's probably the real king of rock and roll, is not an entertainer? Yeah. Baloney. He'll sit here and tell you he's an entertainer. Still is. You look at Al Green. Al Green. Great singer, but Al Green is probably the best to ever walk on a stage. If I have an idol in this music business, it's Al Green, because this man can take an audience, and that's what it's about. It's not about this business. I don't care. I'll stand here on my soapbox till doomsday. It is not about look at your shoe, rock and roll, psychological. Oh, gee, my father came in this afternoon, and I had an argument with him, and I don't owe you anything, okay? That's not what it's about. It is about the extraordinary moments in life. That's what it's about. It's about these moments in life where you say to yourself, rock and roll, because it's extreme. It's supposed to be extreme. Rock and roll is about these situations. When you go, I can't believe this is happening. This can't be real. This isn't real. Now, how many times have you said that in your life? How many times has every person that's ever written a rock and roll song said that in their life? That's the moments you write about, not about the cup of coffee you had this morning when you woke up and you felt a little blue. Blues singers, the early blues. Now, that's where Mick Jagger, that's where the Stones, that's where I, gospel and blues is where I came from. I've never said that before because I refuse to admit that, because everybody and their grandmother admits that. Yeah. I come from a heavy blues roots. Yeah. Shut up. Yeah. You know? And so that's my background is gospel and real. These guys, they were talking about extraordinary moments in gospel songs. They're talking about Jesus coming down from the sky. They're talking about these moments, the gospel singers back in the 1800s and 1840s, and when slavery was going on in America. These gospel singers, they're standing out in the middle of a cotton field and they're picking cotton, and that's where then they're sitting here, and they're sitting there at that time saying, now, it's about these events. They're sitting out there going, I can't believe this is happening. This can't be real. I can't be standing here. Those are extraordinary moments. Mm-hmm. That's the roots. That's the roots of rock and roll. That is the roots of soul. That is the roots of music. That Mozart, when he wrote his piece, you can't get me stopped now. Mozart, when he was sitting there at this thing, he's writing these tormented things because he's saying the same thing. That's what they're saying. You ever, Amadeus, I know, you know, anytime you see a movie you can believe that's supposed to be biographical or, you know, semi or some true story or something, you can believe about 10% of it. But believe the 10% of the tortured soul. Sure. Because he's sitting there going, I can't believe this happens. Yeah. Yeah. And you have to circle a rock and roll song. You can't. It drives me nuts. I mean, I sit here and I listen to this crap and I read this crap and it drives me crazy that they lost the roots.
Okay, but is there room in all of this for, say, Leonard Cohen and Bob Dylan?
Absolutely, they are. Bob Dylan writes about extraordinary events. Bob Dylan, that's what they write about. That's what Leonard Cohen, absolutely. Bob Dylan is like one of my, you know, again. I mean, that's the first record I ever bought was Bob Dylan. And those were, he's extremist. He's a true extremist.
He's a true extremist indeed. Pot kettle. What was I going to say? 24 minutes past 2 o'clock. That's Meatloaf from the mid-90s direction, around 95, I suppose. And one thing about Meatloaf is, I mentioned it earlier on, really there were two of them in some ways. Like, each one, because of the other, became so successful. I mean, we're talking up to 100 million records sold. And the other person is Jim Steinman. And he wrote the big hits of Meatloaf as well. And in fact, there's a quote here when Jim Steinman died about 9 months ago from Meatloaf, and he said, "We didn't know each other, we were each other. We belonged heart and soul," as I mentioned earlier on. So I'll just give you a little bit of Meatloaf talking about Jim Steinman.
But I mean, it's true, isn't it? I mean, like, in one way, Jim Steinman certainly proved some years ago that he's jealous of your success. He wanted it. Like, I mean, after Bat Outta Hell, he'd brought out a solo album.
Well, the only reason he brought that solo album out was because I basically just quit because I didn't agree with that record. And we'd just come off Bat, and Bat, for a period of time in the world, this was 1978, in August, in July, August, and September of 1978, for 3 months, it was the biggest selling album in the world, without a doubt. And that's, I mean, when you start talking on those terms, it's enormous. And what comes out of the woodwork, I mean, like all the monsters come out. Mm. And I mean, they really are monsters. Yeah. All the monsters come out. All the, you know, good and bad monsters. I mean, there's good monsters as well, but they all come out and they're really scary, you know. And if you're not prepared for it and you really don't know how to deal with it, whew, it's a tough thing. And so I didn't know how to deal with it because I don't play that game. I only deal with the work. And so I don't know. I wasn't ready for that. And then what it became about was as we progressed, they started going, okay, you need to get back in the studio. And I'm saying, but we're not ready. And they had already talked to Jim. Jim had come off the road, started to write. So what I figured that I would come off the road, we came off the road in like the end of September of 78, and I figured we'd write for a while, and then sometime in April or May we'd get back together. I needed a break. But they pushed him right in there. And when they did that, I thought they were making a duplicate of Bat Outta Hell. I thought the album that came out, Bad for Good, if I'd have put my voice on it, with Jimmy on it wasn't, but if I'd have had my voice on it and put my input into that record, we would have had a duplicate of Bat Outta Hell, because Dance in My Pants was a duplicate of Paradise, Bad for Good was trying to be a duplicate of Bat Outta Hell. So that's how that record came about, because I quit. I've quit twice, and I threatened to quit this time too, but I didn't.
There you go, Meatloaf, larger than life, force of nature indeed, who died at the age of 74 a couple of days ago. And one other anecdote about Meatloaf is that when he started out and he played his first ever gig, he played with three other people on the bill. He was on first, obviously, it was his first time. And directly after him was Question Mark and the Mysterians, the crowd who brought out that great song, 96 Tears. That was in 1968. And the headline on that gig, not a major venue or anything, was them. As in Van Morrison's band, as in, you know, Belfast them, as in Here Comes the Night, etc. Anyway, 51552 is our text.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.